Do countries need allies? Do alliances necessarily require the member countries to set aside their national interests? These are the questions that the Trump administration has posed in its approach to foreign policy. One of the key claims from President Trump is that countries like South Korea are not paying their fair share of the defense burden. But who has actually done the math on what the South Koreans are contributing to the alliance? Our guest today has done the math, and he believes that we are risking a whole lot more than $5 billion by undermining people's confidence in the US-ROK security alliance. With no further delay, from the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., I'm your host, Yong Kwon, and you're listening to Korean Context. We have with us today KEI Fellow and Director of Academic Affairs, Kyle Ferrier. He is the author of the recent research paper titled Monetizing the Linchpin, Trump's Foreign Policy versus the U.S.-Korea Alliance's Value to Washington. You can find this paper on keia.org. We highly recommend that you take a look. Kyle Ferrier, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me back.
So the U.S.-Korea Alliance, it's one of the oldest alliances that the United States has. It's almost as old as NATO, going back all the way to the beginning of the Cold War period. But recently, we've been hearing a lot of murmurs in the news about challenges that both countries are having with maintaining the alliance, in particular around the burden sharing between the two countries. Could you perhaps give us a quick overview of some of the issues that the Trump administration has raised about the burden sharing issue between South Korea and the United States?
Thanks, Yong. The easiest thing to point to is the recently penned Wall Street Journal op-ed by Secretaries Pompeo and Esper, in which they highlight that South Korea may not be paying into the relationship as much as it should be. And so this is more or less a reflection of President Trump's points that he's been raising pretty much since the 1980s, but more recently during his presidency, talking about how South Korea doesn't pay enough into the relationship and that we should therefore think about withdrawing them. It seems that every possible opportunity, he talks about the Korean Peninsula and mentioning about USFK, US forces Korea. He always has to mention it's costing us a lot and we'd like to bring those troops home. So the SMA negotiations, these burden-sharing talks, the special measures agreement, really is a focal point through which Trump can apply his thinking about alliances and how the U.S. should be paying as much. Maybe we should think about having a smaller footprint overseas and paying less for that footprint, having our allies pay more. We don't really hear it as much in the United States, but it's a big concern in Korea right now.
No doubt, especially given the heightened threats that they saw from North Korea in 2017. I'm sure it's top of mind where the United States sees its long-term presence in the Korean Peninsula. So what you described is kind of the background, the U.S. government verbalizing the rationale for why they're demanding potentially 400% more than what South Korea is currently paying for the U.S.-Korea alliance. Now, let's back up a little bit for the audience. Where does the U.S.-Korea military alliance begin? What is the origin of this relationship?
So, not to get into too much of the details, but the alliance starts really in 1953 with the signing of the Mutual Defense Agreement. And U.S. forces have been stationed there since, more or less to serve as a deterrent against North Korean threat, North Korean provocations, etc. So U.S. troops have been there despite the rapid change that's taken place over the course of the second half of the last century, where Korea's defense capabilities have manifestly improved. Seoul and Washington both see a need for the U.S. forces Korea to be there, ostensibly to counter and address the North Korean threat.
And what was the burden-sharing relationship like in the beginning, and how has it changed over time?
So the burden-sharing issue didn't really start until 1991. There was, in the 60s, a status of forces agreement, which really outlined the presence of U.S. troops in the peninsula and what the U.S. was expected to provide, what the Koreans were expected to provide. In the late 80s, early 90s, the United States and Korea added an addendum to that status of forces agreement to dictate that South Korea should pay more into the non-personnel costs of posting U.S. troops on the peninsula. So that would include like logistics, basing costs, and upkeep, as well as wages for South Korean workers on base. So in 1991, you have the first special measures agreement, which outlines how much South Korea would pay to help with these non-personnel costs. And then in the beginning, they renegotiated about every year, and then it gradually, the time in between each agreement gradually grew. So it went from a year to 3 years to where we're at before the Trump administration took office, every 5 years, renegotiating this deal. And obviously, in any relationship where you're talking about money, it's going to be contentious. But it never boiled over to an extent where it posed a public threat to the relationship as it has now, largely because of the way that it's being approached, the special measures agreement.
We had a conversation late last year with former Foreign Minister Song Min-soon, who expressed very similar views that while the negotiations over the burden sharing between the United States and South Korea, while they were contentious in the mid-1990s when they began, they were done behind closed doors and they were managed in a way that wouldn't affect the broader relationship. Of course, South Korea is not the only country that has U.S. troops. South Korea is not the only country during the Cold War where the United States provided enormous amounts of military assistance. There's Japan, there's Spain, there's other countries that have been recipients. So is it the case that South Korea is being singled out by the Trump administration, or is this a reflection of a broader Trump administration worldview that is being applied to South Korea?
I wish I could say this is only limited to South Korea, but it's definitely South Korea is a symptom of a larger trend within the Trump administration to challenge all these alliances around the world. I think this has been very, very clear since he took office, attacking NATO, Korea. Whereas NATO, he talks about 2% of GDP, defense spending target isn't being met. South Korea far exceeds that, but then they use different metrics to talk about South Korea not paying enough. And now with Japan's timing for their own special measures agreement coming, theirs expires next year, and they have to renegotiate it by the end of the fiscal year, which I think for Japan ends sometime next spring. So they have to restart those negotiations, much like what's going on with South Korea. But Japan is definitely being targeted along those same lines. When former National Security Advisor John Bolton went to Japan, there was a lot of rumors that he told the Japanese that they would also be expected to pay about a $5 billion increase, which is what the United States has asked South Korea to pay. So it falls along similar lines. I think Korea has been hit pretty hard with this negotiation just because of the timing, really. When Trump came into office in 2017, the SMA was set to expire at the end of 2018. And so over the course of the administration, he pushed harder on South Korea, largely in part because of when their SMA was set to come due and therefore have to be renegotiated.
And because, as you mentioned, the metrics are being applied so inconsistently between Europe and South Korea and Japan, your research paper, Monetizing the Linchpin, is an incredibly important anchor for the discussions around how we should think about this burden-sharing question. Because at a broad level, the U.S. government does bring a legitimate point that allies should bear a fair share of the burden. But you're suggesting that South Korea's contributions to the US-RK alliance and the broader US interest in the Asia-Pacific is much larger than what the US government is actually giving credit for. And in particular, you point out three areas where this is happening. And I was hoping that we could walk through these three areas.
Be happy to.
First and foremost, you mentioned that because the principal objective of the US-ROK security alliance is to prevent the return of armed conflict in the Korean Peninsula, this presents a major cost saving to US taxpayers. Now, understandably, there would be enormous harm to South Korea if there was a war in the Korean Peninsula. But could you explain to audiences how, if there's a war in the Korean Peninsula, this would affect the United States?
Sure. And I think this is something that's sort of left out. In the Wall Street Journal, the argument put forward by Pompeo and Esper, they're talking about the unforeseen costs of U.S. presence on the peninsula, which, you know, there are. There are also unforeseen benefits, and this is really what I try and tackle in the paper. By having an effective deterrence against North Korea vis-a-vis U.S. forces there, you're essentially helping to prevent a second Korean War. The economic instability brought on by a second Korean War would be really devastating for the United States. There's been a number of different studies done in terms of what war costs the United States and Iraq and Afghanistan. And The official U.S. number is around $1.5 trillion in war-related obligations, but then external studies have also shown, well, this number could be a lot higher, somewhere in the range of $4 to $6 trillion. And experts generally tend to agree that war on the Korean Peninsula would be a lot more costly, namely because of the asymmetric capabilities that North Korea has, including its nuclear weapons program. There was one Economist Intelligence Unit, a report back in 2017 at the height of Fire and Fury, that said if there was a war on the Korean Peninsula near the end of 2017, the U.S. GDP the following year would have dropped from 2.7%, the projected 2.7% for the following year, 2018, that would have dropped to about 1% GDP growth, which would have cost the U.S. economy over $330 billion in just 1 year. Another 2017 report done by Gareth Leather and Crystal Tan of Capital Economics found that if there was another Korean war, that the fall in Korean GDP, because it represents such a large chunk of the global economy today, could result in global production dropping by 1.5%, which would ostensibly be trillions of dollars for global trade, global economy, global finance. And Korea is so globally integrated, not just on trade and finance, but on really important production chains, including on semiconductors, which are really key to major growth industries for the future.
Right, like AI, automated vehicles, other consumer electronics. And, you know, for people who have been traveling through the American South, this should come as no surprise, but one is often struck by how much South Korean investments there are in the southeast of the United States, in Georgia, in Alabama. Numerous South Korean plants, steel fabricators, car manufacturing, all those would also evaporate in the occasion of a war on the Korean Peninsula, which would cost hundreds of thousands of jobs and associated employment in the United States.
Exactly, and that's a lot harder to estimate, but South Korea is also one of the fastest growing sources of FDI in the United States, so you're just eliminating all that potential growth as well. So there's really just a lot of economic benefit that stability brings.
What you're describing is, of course, the worst case scenario in the region, a war restarting on the Korean Peninsula. But you also know that even as we maintain the status quo, that as the United States tries to maintain regional stability, South Korea still plays a very key role in the immediate region of Northeast Asia through what you call the convergence in policy towards North Korea and China. Could you briefly overview what you mean by that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So the U.S.-Korea relationship is strong, and because the United States is essentially a security backstop for South Korea, it helps to temper South Korean foreign policy from moving too far away from what would be aligned with U.S. interests. So for instance, progressive politicians in South Korea who have risen to power, essentially there's always been this concern that they would break with the United States and the alliance because they're skeptical of the U.S. But when push comes to shove and they're in office, they pursue, even if they're more inclined towards pursuing policies that are antithetical with what the United States wants to do, they always sort of toe the line to an extent because the alliance with the U.S. is so important. So the maximum pressure policy the Trump administration is trying to put on North Korea is really buttressed by the Moon administration not going forward with all of its inter-Korean economic engagement projects. So the want to adhere to international sanctions is part and parcel to wanting to adhere to what the line is with the United States.
So what you're essentially saying is that the U.S. military alliance with South Korea and the presence of U.S. troops on the Korean Peninsula stabilizes South Korea's foreign policy even when there is changes in the party in the Blue House. And as a result, because there's consistency in South Korea's policy towards North Korea, it amplifies U.S. policy towards North Korea, helping perhaps achieve denuclearization and normalization of North Korea at some point.
Exactly.
Now, one might argue, if you are perhaps an isolationist in the United States, one might argue that this is still South Korea's problem. Denuclearization of North Korea, you know, North Korea not being so belligerent in the Korean Peninsula is still South Korea's problem. Why should the United States bear this cost? But I found a very interesting passage in your paper where you describe the case study of China-South Korea relationship, where South Korea bore enormous losses financially to uphold a security promise that South Korea has made to the United States. Would you be able to walk us through that incident and that case study?
The issue I'm looking at in my paper is the deployment of the Missile Defense Battery THAAD, the Terminal High Area Altitude Defense Battery, which the U.S. sent to South Korea under the Park Geun-hye administration. Both sides had agreed to this missile defense battery because it would help shoot down any potential missiles coming from North Korea. Government in Beijing saw this system as potentially infringing upon its sovereignty because of the radar looking north towards North Korea, they had argued, was also extending into Beijing airspace so that the United States could use that to defend itself against attack from Beijing. So it was seen as an aggressive move by the United States and South Korea. So what the government in Beijing did was that they pressured the South Korean government by financially targeting several South Korean companies and industries. They went after the Chaebol Group Lotte, which gave the land to the government to put the THAAD battery on. They targeted Chinese tourism to South Korea. They targeted beauty products, confectionery, and an array of different Korean products in China. And looking at the cost borne by those companies, you could easily see that cost South Korean companies about $25 billion. And South Korea continued to uphold the agreement with the United States for the THAAD battery. And looking at those numbers, you kind of make the argument, well, look at all the costs borne by South Korea in order to keep to a strong alliance relationship with the United States, in order to keep that policy continuity with the U.S. So these were really important costs borne by South Korea, which the U.S. essentially didn't do anything to help or respond. The most that the U.S. did was some senators wrote a letter urging President Trump to raise the issue with President Xi when they had a meeting in 2017. Trump raised it with Xi, and that was the last we heard of it. So the U.S. didn't really do anything to try and help South Korea, as South Korea was taking flak for trying to help the alliance. And that $25 billion losses to South Korean companies really can be seen as contributions in a way to keeping U.S. policy relevant on the Korean Peninsula.
And per your earlier point, this deployment of THAAD took place over two different administrations in South Korea from two different parties. And despite this being a campaign issue where the parties were on opposing sides, because of the U.S.-South Korea security alliance, there was policy consistency when there was a change in administration. Mm-hmm. And so this, again, strengthens your argument from earlier that the U.S.-Korea security alliance really does create an environment where South Korea can maintain a consistent foreign policy that in turn amplifies U.S. foreign policy in the region. Now, beyond the myopic scope of Northeast Asia, and maybe I shouldn't call it myopic given the millions and millions of people that live there, but the final point that you make in your paper is that the U.S.-South Korea Security Alliance isn't just for Northeast Asia. It has a wider value to the way the United States amplifies its interest in the broader Asia-Pacific region. Could you walk us through what you mean by that and perhaps give us some examples of how that might be?
Sure. This is actually my favorite part to write because I think it's an unknown part of the relationship, how South Korea is involved in the rest of the region. And it's really important and super underappreciated. So I kind of looked at what our U.S. policy is in the region and how South Korea is helping buttress that, even though they're not necessarily following the same policy agenda. And what I mean is that the United States has this free and open Indo-Pacific strategy, which has sort of defined the Trump administration policy towards East Asia since he's come into office. South Korea being dependent on trade with China, as well as needing China for helping to resolve the North Korea issue, is very hesitant to sign on with the free and open Indo-Pacific agenda, more or less because they see it as something that could be looking to directly contain China. So South Korea has eschewed joining on that free and Indo-Pacific strategy itself, but at the same time, there's a lot of complementarities between the two, and South Korea's own new southern policy in the region helps to augment what the U.S. is trying to do, even though, like I said before, they're not necessarily always working together on the same exact thing. So I kind of show this by looking at arms sales and aid in the region. As a 2019 RAND study points out. Its defense exports are largely helpful for building up capacity among regional actors who may not be able to afford U.S. hardware. It might be too expensive. South Korea fills a niche there. These arms sales also help undercut continuing Russian influence in the region while also representing an obstacle to Chinese efforts to build influence through arms sales. So South Korea, as a free and open democracy in the region, by selling to these other partners like India, Indonesia, the Philippines, they help buttress the same regional order and the same rules that the United States is helping to or is hoping to maintain in the region. At least since 2000, South Korea has been very active in doing this. They've exported or invested at least $12.5 billion in military hardware for regional partners. On official development assistance, this is another area where South Korea is very active. It's the only country in the world to have gone from being a net aid recipient to being a net aid giver. It feels a certain responsibility to give back to the world through aid, and the Asia Pacific is actually the area where South Korea has spent the most on aid since 1988. So 36% of its aid has actually gone to the region. And if you look at net ODA flows to the Indo-Pacific over that period, it's close to $8 billion that South Korea has given to help build infrastructure, to help develop civil society in Southeast Asia, which is something that the United States is really trying to do itself. And as the United States is having difficulty mobilizing funds for these endeavors, South Korea is augmenting what the U.S. is otherwise trying to do, even when they're not explicitly coordinating policy through the auspices of the alliance.
If I may ask, how does exactly creating and building a deeper civil society in Southeast Asia help U.S. interests?
There's concern that through the Belt and Road Initiative, Chinese investment is overtaking the state through debt diplomacy and having a strong civil society to push back against a lot of these deals that are perceived to be not inclusive of the community. And so I think that the U.S. is really trying to, at least the Trump administration is really trying to limit the ability of these countries to be too in debt.
So from a geostrategic level, because Chinese loans are very attractive to many of these Southeast Asian governments, there is a fear that the Southeast Asian governments might, without taking into consideration long-term consequences, take on these loans that might actually oblige them to China's geostrategic policies in the future. And having a civil society that can say, no, these dams are unnecessary, that these ports are actually bad for the local environment and local economy, and saying that maybe there are other issues that are more important than, say, building a thermal power plant, like pushing back against salinization of the water system. By creating civil society that can voice these opposing opinions, the United States is encouraging these countries to some degree push back against China's geostrategic designs in the region that are quite sometimes anti-democratic and also quite oppressive at times.
Exactly.
Now, you went through an incredible array of interesting information about how our security alliance with South Korea prevents the return of armed conflict in the Korean Peninsula, which saves the United States enormous amount of cost, both in terms of the immediate cost to our trade in the region and also investments from South Korea. The alliance also helps amplify our own ability to pressure North Korea into denuclearization. And finally, that South Korea is an amplifying force when it comes to our own interest in Southeast Asia and Asia Pacific as a whole. These are an array of incredible information. We're very glad that you wrote this paper, and I hope that people listening to this will take time to go check it out on KEIA.org. Now, Kyle, to finish up, if you were to go on a speaking tour across the United States today to speak on this issue, what is the one fact that you would like American audiences to walk away with?
Well, thanks for all your kind words, Jung. I would just like to finish up by saying that South Korea is not a dependent. Yes, there is room for Koreans to pay more into relationship. And I was in Korea in September, and many of the experts who work on these issues agreed that there is. But it's the way in which the Trump administration is approaching this, which is at fault. And by singularly only focusing on cost, you're undermining everything else in the relationship, which is really where the true value is.
That's it for our episode today. Many thanks to Kyle Ferrier and to you, listeners, for tuning in. You can find Kyle's paper, Monetizing the Lynchpin, in the description of this episode. While you're here, we would really appreciate you rating Korean Context on your podcasting platform and leaving us a comment. it helps more people find our podcast. We'll be back next week. See you then.